This podcast is brought to you by Electric Power Systems. EPS is a leading provider of high-power, scalable powertrains that are certifiable for electrified aviation. It develops energy storage systems, DC fast charging stations, and electric propulsion products for aerospace, defense, automotive, marine, and industrial traction industries.
Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of the Aviation Renaissance with Spencer and Spencer. We would like to give a shout out today to one of our newest partners, JetBlue. You got to stop that.
I can't.
Okay.
It has to happen.
Talk about JetBlue.
Okay. Over 280 aircraft fly all over. Great service, great name as well. I think they've been around for 24 years. JetBlue was started in the 90s. That's right. I know that's right. I'm not going to get more specific than that, but shout out to JetBlue.
My aunt Karen Grange started with JetBlue and retired with JetBlue. So,
oh wow,
yeah, that's a shout out to my aunt. She lives in Maryland now,
somewhere in the Northeast.
Anyway, you've already heard him talk. Today's guest is Joe James,
Hey-o.
Associate Fellow of Mechanical Systems. Joe, the floor is yours, sir. Tell us about yourself.
Oh, man.
Let's start with, I would say little tiny Joe James, but I don't think you've ever been small your entire life. So let's just go with...
I used to be a baby, just like everybody.
Yeah, but I'm sure you came out as like a 15-pound baby.
I was actually an average-sized baby.
Okay.
we're getting right into it.
Yeah, we are.
From the beginning.
Joe is 6'9"? 6'8"?
6'7".
6'7". Oh, those 2 inches make a huge difference.
High expectations.
High expectations. You're a big fella. So, little, tiny, 10-year-old Joe James.
10. I don't know why 10.
I don't know why.
That's where we're going.
Let's start off at 10-year-old Joe James.
Where was I living? I lived a lot of different places when I was growing up. So, 10 years old, I was in Phoenix.
Oh, Phoenix sucks.
Arizona. Yeah, did a lot of... was big into Legos, actually.
I had quite a
Lego collection, and all the guys would come over and we'd build Legos at 10 years old. I had a big backyard. We'd take them out and lose all the pieces. Mom would get mad at me.
Is that where the architecture, of your design came from? Was Legos?
Well, Legos. Well, we can get down to the psychology to it, and there's probably some aspects of my Lego enthusiasm.
Have you always had a mechanical geared brain?
Yes, but not consciously. In fact, I was a business major in college.
Oh, wow.
That's what I started off as. And so, yeah, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 degrees, and that's because I couldn't make up my mind.
Whoa, okay. So
this seems to be a running competition
this has been now. The last month, everybody.
Everybody is overachievers. You are an overachiever.
Oh, yeah?
Nicole Tuttle is an overachiever. Stephanie is an overachiever.
You just kept counting
Celeste.
The amount of candies I eat in an evening, and you just did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
It's like crackers or degrees.
Not candies, man. Monster energies.
Monsters. Nah, yeah. 6 is a little.
What are your 6 degrees in, Joe?
So I've got 2 undergraduate business degrees and then 2 associate degrees and then my bachelor's in mechanical engineering and then a master's in mechanical engineering.
Where did you go to school?
So my undergrad and...
Which one?
Yeah, specify.
All the undergrads were at Arizona State University.
Another ASU.
Yeah, the Sun Devils.
There's lots of them.
Sun Devils.
And I remember the time when I decided I wanted to do mechanical engineering. I was sitting in front of a counselor, and I was trying to figure out my next classes for my business degree. And she was the first person in my entire life. Nobody had ever asked me this. Joe, do you want to do a business degree? And I'm like, well, maybe. It seems like a good idea. And then she's like, well, what do you like to do? And then, we had a conversation.
I like to build Legos.
Well, at that time, my buddy had a 69 Nova that we were tearing apart and building back up. And I just loved it. And so I told her, and she's like, well, have you ever thought about being a mechanical engineer? And I says, well, yeah. Do you want to be a mechanical engineer? And I said, yes. And I never looked back. That was it.
Is that where you got your master's as well?
Nope. Got my master's from Utah State. I'm an Aggie.
Oh, wow.
Had to be assimilated into the culture here. So,
oh, well, so Phoenix, where else?
Let's see. I've lived in, so I graduated high school in Utah, but I grew up mostly in Phoenix, lived in Las Vegas, San Jose, Bay Area for several years. Yeah. And then also down in Southern Utah.
Was this all with your family?
Yes and no. I kind of left the nest at an early age and wanted to be on my own, be independent. I'm the youngest of 8 children.
Hey.
So, yeah, I wanted to get out of that as soon as possible.
And, I am the second youngest of 8, so get it. I know it.
I did not know that.
But don't your parents kind of just, I was the youngest, but didn't they just kind of be like, do whatever you want, you know? I mean, why'd you want to get out that fast? They probably acted like you weren't there anyways.
Well, I've thought about this, and my siblings have thought about it a lot more.
It's hard to not acknowledge Joe when he's around. So I'm very aware. I'm sure that his parents were very aware that he was in the house.
Oh, goodness. I just wanted to make my own choices, get out of the house. I had my first job when I was 14. Chevron. Yeah, and I did all the dirty stuff there and wanted to buy things that my parents didn't want me to buy. And so, like a computer, I built my first computer when I was 15. Whoa. Saved up for it. It was pretty exciting.
It's pretty similar to my background. I didn't want to be in the house. I wanted to go to work and be able to have the things for myself. And because when you grow up in a big family, there's not a lot of money to go around, is there?
And you got to fight for everything you have, including attention. And then I realize, and it's funny because if my siblings ever listen to this, they're just going to be like, psh, oh, Joe got all the attention. We're Joe got whatever he wanted. He got away with murder.
Yeah. That's the youngest of 8 children. I
mean. And I'm just looking back and I don't know.
How is it split in your family, your siblings?
I have two sisters and the rest are brothers.
It's 4 and 4 in mine. 4 boys, 4 girls.
Oh, really? And so is the youngest a boy or a girl in your family?
Girl. It goes 3 boys, 3 girls, me, and then my little sister.
It's not a bad spread.
Yeah. I love my big family. Definitely don't want a big family of my own.
I know, right? I'm wondering if there's a correlation there. When I met my wife, when we were talking, dating, it was like, how many kids do you want? And I said, 1? Maybe 2.
Right.
And then she's going to deny this, but she wanted 6. Mm. She wanted to be, because guess what? She came from a small family and she was the oldest. Mm. She was only 2 people in her family.
Well, I wonder if there's a correlation, because my wife comes from a big family, but she's the second oldest of 7 kids. And she was more on the 6 kids boat as well. Is it the younger end of the big families that they're just like,
I think so.
Buck stops with me.
Because my second oldest brother has 7 kids.
Yeah, there it is.
And see? Everybody right else in my family has 3 or below.
Ah, I wonder if the perception is different. I thought about it. The reason why I don't want a huge family is because kind of when you get back to a big family, there's not a lot just generally to go around. And sure. I wanted to have a bigger relationship than I had with my parents with my own kids.
Sure.
And so that requires time, that requires resources. And that's not to say people that have big families can't spread the love around. You know, I have my own certain capacities as a person to be able to
take
care of.
You don't have to smile. We all have capacities.
I know some individuals. We work some people that have like 9 kids. Good grief, man. I couldn't imagine.
I can't imagine either. I have 2. And after my second one was born, I said, hey, doc, make it so I can't have any more because I don't want any more.
Hey, you put a stop to that real quick.
I did. I deconstructed that highway.
This is a great conversation. It is.
It's just funny because I can relate with Spencer so well right now.
Yeah,
I
know. Yeah, this is awesome.
Yep.
But you want to know what's really funny, though, is my after my second, I looked at my wife and says, so are we done? And she's like, hell yes, we are done. So she saw the light, and which is good. And we have our 2 kids, boy and a girl.
Very good. In fact, your son invited me to his birthday party when we saw him at the gas station, and I am very upset that I didn't get an invitation.
Oh, I will be sure to forward that message along to my 5-year-old.
Okay, because we saw you at the gas station, and he invited me.
That was a year ago.
That was a year ago.
Do you know why I know that? Because his birthday is in 2 weeks.
Oh, can so I come to his birthday party?
So you're inviting him to this birthday party this year,
well,
right?
Unless you want to come out to California. We're having it at Grandma and Grandpa's.
Oh, he's going.
No, thanks. I just came back from Phoenix and I got COVID down there, so I don't want to travel again.
Ooh, especially in Phoenix. Just recently?
Yeah, I was 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago I was in Phoenix down for EMI testing for one of our customers. And then I came back, I went to the office for a day, and then I started feeling not the best. So I took a COVID test and came back positive. And it's the first time I've ever had it.
Yucky, yucky.
Yeah, I'm over it. I'm all good now. Mm. So enough about that.
10 minutes in.
Let's talk about your work history, Joe.
Sure.
Where did you, once you graduated with your mechanical engineering degree, your undergrad, not your master's, where did you go work?
Yeah, so my professional career started off right after I got my bachelor's in mechanical engineering. And I actually started off my career as a test driver for Audi Volkswagen.
Whoa, cool.
Doing pre and post-production vehicles. A lot of fun.
What was the coolest car you drove?
The coolest car, you should ask me the coolest car I rode in after that.
Okay.
The coolest car I got to drive was a Bentley coupe, had a W12 engine in it, and I got to take it on the high speed track several times.
What was the coolest car you rode in?
Definitely an R8.
Oh man, those are nice cars.
So are we correlating cool to expensive, or
have you ever
some correlation?
have you ever ridden in either one of those
cars? No, I have not.
So my real estate partner has a brand new RS7.
Oh, really?
Nice. He let me drive it. It's a lot of fun.
They handle very well. They're close to 100 degrees or 100 miles per hour.
Yes, they do. Okay, so Audi, Volkswagen.
Yeah.
That's where you started as a test driver.
Yeah, test driver, test engineer.
Oh, okay.
And I wanted to get into their design group. They have a really interesting program. It was back just right after the recession, just a couple of years after the recession from 2008. And so the job market wasn't too terribly great. And that's when I moved to a startup company actually called Helodyne, and they were doing some really cool things. They were trying to make advancements in the oil and gas industry, making power generation units for offshore oil platforms. Mm. So typically they use like a diesel generation set to power the offshore oil rig. Whether it's manned or unmanned, and that is very, very expensive, not just from a fuel perspective, but also a maintenance perspective. Mm. What a lot of people don't know is that offshore oil platforms typically have high and low pressure lines that they naturally get from the well that they're mining from. Mm. And so this company's idea was they had created a machine called an expander. And expanders aren't new. There's lots of things called expanders. They just take something from high to low pressure to generate shaft power or electricity. And so they wanted to tap into this energy resource that these offshore oil rigs naturally had, and to generate power that would not just reduce fuel costs, fuel consumption, but also maintenance. So it was a very robust system. So I worked there for almost 3 years, and man, that was a lot of fun. Very, very similar to EPS. A lot of energy, a lot of excitement, a lot of innovation.
Was it successful?
It's successful from a technological standpoint. Unfortunately, it does take quite a bit of capital equipment and costs to get a company like that up and running. And so there was, of course, some financial troubles, which pushed me onto my next adventure, which actually brought me up here into Cache Valley.
What's that?
Never been to Cache Valley before. I came to a company called Automation Products Group, still in the oil and gas and aerospace industries, making mostly sensors and things like ultrasonic sensors, transducers, pressure sensors, things like that. And it was really neat because I was on the hunt for a different job, and I'd never been to Logan, and they had a career fair that was for professionals that I saw online, and actually decided to make the drive up here. Mm-hmm. And I came in the springtime, it was gorgeous. I came down from Sardine Canyon. It was green. It was beautiful. The weather was perfect. And I said, wow, what a gem. This wouldn't be a bad place to live. And then I moved. Oops. The day I moved was January 7th. And it was -4 degrees outside when we were moving in.
Yep.
I took my wife to a local restaurant here, Angie's, and I just looked at her and I said, I'm sorry. Because you got to remember, we were in Phoenix and then St. George before then. Right. So this was it was a complete flip. But we're glad we did.
The wintertime has its own kind of beauty to it as well.
Well, it only took us about a year to acclimate. And it's wonderful to get four seasons.
It is.
You do not get four seasons in Phoenix.
No. Mm-hmm. You get one and a half.
You get sweaty, hot.
And not sweaty hot.
And then somewhat comfortable. Two seasons.
2 weeks ago when I was there, I landed on a Sunday and it was 105.
Ugh.
And I stepped off the airplane. And it was later in the evening, too. And I was like, ugh, I feel like I'm back in the Middle East. This is horrible. And by that time I left on Friday, it was 113.
Yeah.
No, oh, no thanks.
See, and the problem, oh, I shouldn't say, probably, there's a lot of good people live in Phoenix. Phoenix is a wonderful place that I'll never live in ever again. But growing up in Phoenix, we would have these pool parties and they would always have to be at midnight because it's just too hot. And even when you jump in the pool at midnight, it's like jumping into a hot tub.
I went down and the hotel had a swimming pool. And I was like, oh, I didn't bring my swim truck. So I went and bought some. And then when I got off of work every night, I'd go into the hotel. Well, it was like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd go into the hotel. I'd put on my swim trunks. I'd look outside and I'd go, nope. And then I'd just lay on my hotel bed until it was time to go to bed. I didn't even want to go swim.
Just cuddle up next to the AC unit.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
So you came up here for a career fair.
Yeah, and I didn't actually get anything from the career fair, but I was so intrigued with my first visit to Logan, Utah, that I wanted to work here. So I was on the hunt for companies that were hiring, and that's when I found a local company called Automation Products Group, APG. Mm-hmm. And they've been around for about 30 years, and I was their first mechanical engineer that they've ever hired. Oh. And I got to start up that group, and I built it to just about four individuals. A small mechanical engineering team, and it was really good, really good experience. Learned a lot of good people there. I kind of went as high as I could go, and I was hungry for some more. I was hungry for some things maybe a little bit more challenging, something that was cutting edge and opening up in a new industry. And that's where I actually found, well, I found EPS when I was at Automation Products Group. And interesting story, a lot of people get on here, and they might have bragging rights about what employee they were.
Well, here we go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, I haven't even told Mike or Nate this or Randy this, but I was working at EPG and I was on the hunt, and I saw the news article where EPS was kind of coming to Logan, and so I decided to give him a call, and I sent Randy an email and say, hey, I'm a mechanical engineer. If you need any help, I'm looking for a different job, looking for something, you know, a little bit more in depth. And it seems like you guys are starting to do some hard things and being in the aerospace industry. And he said, let's talk. And so I actually had several conversations with Randy and Nate about developing, I believe it was the cab battery, actually, mm-hmm. the cooling jacket for the cab battery. And they said, well, no, we don't have anything right now, but we can definitely do some moonlighting work. And so we had a little bit of an exchange there. But that was actually 2 years before I actually got hired on.
I did not know that.
So it was even before they moved to Logan. They were still in the transition phases. So.
So how long have you officially been with EPS?
I got hired on in October of 2019, so it'll be just over 2.5 years.
Yeah, we're not that far apart. I was in February of 2020.
Just a couple months after.
We're old timers now.
we're the veterans of EPS.
We are the old crusties, because I was gone for 2 weeks, you know, Phoenix, COVID, came back into the office today. I'm like, who are all of these new people?
I know, right?
In like 2 weeks.
It's a fun game we get to play at EPS now. It's, are they a vendor, a new employee, or a customer?
Right.
That's the fun game.
So 2.5 years, just over 2.5 years with EPS. What do you think so far?
It's been a wild ride.
It has been.
It has been truly, truly, and I mean this, the best of times and the worst of times. It's been extremely difficult and extremely gratifying. I can honestly say that I have accelerated my career more so just because of the challenges and problems that we've been trying to solve at EPS, more so than I think at any other opportunity that could have been provided to me.
Awesome. Hey, you and I actually have bragging rights over everybody else in the company.
Oh, yeah? We probably have one or two. What are the ones you're thinking of?
So you and I built the first project in the new building.
We did.
Yes, we did.
And we did. And it was late at night. And it was an exciting night, if I recall.
It was, yes.
You keep using the word exciting. Uh-huh. I don't think that word means what you think it means.
There were sparks.
Oh, yes. Many sparks. Not too many. Not as many sparks as there could have been.
No, definitely. There was one small flame.
Wonder how facetious we can be about this.
No, we had that privilege and that honor of doing that project together.
It was a good one. It was for a new application. It was a brand new battery design that EPS had never done before.
So. That was fun to weld.
Yeah. Luckily, we've got the robots on now because we've got a similar program that's going on for that battery design, and that was a good time.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. What do you see the future of EPS?
The future of EPS.
Well, I have an interesting perspective about EPS, and it's non-conventional and maybe somewhat controversial. Me personally, but it also answers the question, why do I want to stay at EPS as well? It's I gravitate towards innovation and challenges, seeking out relationships between what man can do and what natural law provides. And it's the quintessential art of engineering itself. So there's a lot of engineers in the world. And unfortunately, I can honestly say that I myself experienced this. Not all of engineers have the opportunity to do true engineering at such a high duty cycle or such a high rate. Mm. So at EPS, we even have a goal for it. It's called a transfer rate. How much time is an engineer actually doing engineering versus, you know, change orders, paperwork, things like that. It's called, and we have an 85% minimum goal transfer rate. Whoa. And it is an aggressive goal, even for a company that tries to be as efficient as EPS. It's still quite difficult. But it provides me personally with what I find valuable in my career, that opportunity to work on truly hard engineering problems, things that you cannot just Google, things that you just cannot search and re-solve a problem that somebody else has already solved. We are truly solving problems that people maybe have thought of, and they have lots of different ideas, but there's actually nothing that's stuck against the wall that's certifiable, that is on the market today, that's a high volume product. And that is exhilarating for me. And the reason why I say it's a little bit controversial is because I'm more gravitating towards the challenge, not necessarily the industry. Now, my graduate degree, my master's degree is in aerospace propulsion products, and I loved it, but I truly, me personally, just to get everything out on the table, I really could be in any industry that has hard problems to solve. And this company, this industry, I don't see how anybody could provide more of a challenge in the current climate. It's truly a transition, an aviation renaissance, as we often say.
I wouldn't say that's controversial at all, because I think you're trying to differentiate between we're trying to make something to full production, right? So it's hard now, but we want to make it easier, right? Is kind of the future. But that's not going to be easy. You know, it's never going to be easy. So I think it's always a good idea to focus on the challenge. Now, Joe, you did say in one of our promotional videos that you wanted engineers at EPS who could think through ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
Is that ambiguity going to be at EPS forever, you think?
Well, if we continue to try and tackle the really hard problems, ambiguity just is synonymous with innovation. Mm-hmm. If there wasn't any ambiguity, it would be fully defined. People would have a path forward to navigate, and it would actually become kind of mundane. So the ambiguity actually kind of makes it exciting.
Mm-hmm.
We hope to reduce the ambiguity moving further along, because we're going to have an established product line. The Epic ecosystem is going to be coming online here very, very soon, and that's going to enable flight. When we get there, when we get airplanes up in the air, regularly running, the next question that I want EPS to ask is, what is next? Mm. What is that next step? What is that next level? And what's great about this industry that I just truly love is that there is a roadmap of challenges that we have to tackle. Right now, it's how do we get these 200 to 250 watt hour per kilogram applications up in the air. Mm. Next, what about regional flights, transcontinental flights, space flight? It just goes on and on, and there's plenty of challenges on the horizon.
I think that those challenges will be there long after our 10 years at EPS have
gosh, come I sure and gone. Hope so.
Because I mean, like you said, right, we're working on small flight trainer style aircraft.
Right.
But then you have your regional stuff, a plane that can carry 20 passengers to Denver. And then you're looking at your intercontinental from the East Coast to the West Coast. And then you've got to fly across either Pacific or the Atlantic, right? Yep. In these massive airplanes powered by electric power. So I think those challenges are going to continue to be there. And it's not simply scaling up, taking our ecosystem and replacing a whole bunch of cargo space on a 737 with batteries. There's a lot more that goes into it than just that. And those are the kind of challenges that you're talking about.
Oh, it is. It is in depth. And it even goes beyond that. So we predominantly work with lithium ion technology. Right. And some of the best conversations that I've been able to have is with Dr. Belt and Dr. Armstrong that we work with. And these conversations are revolved around the technology itself, not lithium ion batteries. Lithium ion batteries and cells are what's enabling the technology today. Mm-hmm. But what happens in 15 years, 20 years when we start to cap out the capability of lithium ion technology? Again, that same question, what's next? Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing I think to answer that question, my good friend Spencer, is EPS is always data driven. Which is, I absolutely love it about this company. Because that means that if something else comes out that is a better technology that we need to adopt and adapt to and develop and get into a mainstream product line, we will do it. If it makes sense, if the technology, the business case, the viability is there, I don't believe that we will shy away from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we haven't already. No, we typically started off, I know with my first few projects that I worked on with EPS, we were using cylindrical cells. Mm-hmm. And we still use those occasionally for certain applications, but we're more geared towards pouch cells now just because of the energy density based on those.
And the packaging efficiency, it we got smarter.
Yeah.
We learned about these things our CEO, Nate Millicum, has a saying that I just truly love. We reserve the right to be smarter, which means that we don't know everything right now. And as long as we're brave enough to acknowledge that and vulnerable enough to understand what we know now and where we need to go, we can always navigate that path. And some companies will shy away from that. And it's really what's really exciting about EPS is that they haven't shown that yet. They haven't Mm-mm. shown that fear of navigating the unknown as long as there's some data to back it up.
Well, it's also not just diving headfirst into this unknown, you know, fear. It's doing it in a way that mitigates risk. I mean, we're always going to have risk. You have to have risk to innovate and that kind of stuff. But we're very good about mitigating that kind of risk and doing our de-risk testing and our process before we actually put something into real time and send it off to a customer.
Oh man, it's a great comment. Our design reviews, for instance, is a great example. We have a first design review called a PDR, preliminary design review. And the essence of that review is, do you have enough data to show that it's possible? You have a path moving forward. And then we have a final design review, which is called a critical design review or CDR. And in that design review, you need to show the objective evidence to show that yes, it does work, which is great.
You've just explained that in one sentence better than I've heard it from probably a dozen different people. So we need to like put that on a wall somewhere because that was pretty phenomenal.
Oh man.
But even after our final design review, when we start building these things and making them happen and we go through our various testings, we get surprises. Sometimes
one or two.
And sometimes those surprises end up in literal flames.
Yep.
And it's a whole reset, redesign, but I've never seen us shy away from it. We've always tackled that challenge head on and we've always overcome it.
Yeah, the key to true development I've learned at EPS is not shying away from failure. Failure is not the problem. It's not getting up and keeping the needle moving forward. When you have a failure, it's not that something bad happened. It's that you learn something that you didn't know before. And that's mm-hmm. truly what it is in its heart. Now, there's of course some pain behind it. But you know, you have schedule and you have budget that you need to keep on top of, and you know, there's expectations to drive. But at the essence of innovation, it is being brave and not fearing to just go for it. Do it right we have the cultural aspect of doing the job right. And but you cannot stop when you do find a failure. I mean, I'm thinking about the Epic Energy module right now. we have a containment inside of the Epic Energy module, and we went through not just different configurations, but different materials. And I remember we had a failure that we just couldn't figure out. And we went through the different permutations of things that could fix this failure. And then we came up with a solution. And gosh darn it, everybody thought it was the most brilliant solution. It was going to fix the whole world, this solution. It was going to solve all the problems. And we go and test. It not only failed, it was the worst failure that we've had out of any of the tests. Oh. But we learned something phenomenal about our choice. And we put it in our logs, in our books, in our design guide, and say, don't use this solution. It's not going to work.
One thing I also do like about the culture at EPS is a good idea can come from anybody.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be a holder of 6 degrees, you know, it, and I have experienced that firsthand. Like, if it's a good idea and it's viable and you can put it into play and it works, it doesn't matter who it came from.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually encourage you to speak up. And I know from my time on the operations floor, working with your engineers, that they're all very open to different problems and different solutions. And it's a great culture to be in.
I've had that experience with you, Spencer.
Yes, you have.
On that previous battery design that we were talking about.
Yep.
So, oh, absolutely. Boots on the ground are a great source. They see things from a different perspective, and it's that that diversity of thought that is also just one of those key elements for innovation. Not a single person or a single group can think about everything. And so when you have different people in different environments that have different objectives, they're going to take a look at a problem in a different way, and that solution could very well come from that perspective.
Yep. It's been good.
That's been great. So, Joe, we're just kind of wrapping up here. Any last comments you want to tell the listeners about you or EPS?
Well, I'm an engineer, and I'll always be an engineer
at
heart.
Couldn't figure that one out.
So all the things that I say are typically engineering. Even when I'm with my wife, I'll say things that are just engineering words, and we'll be with friends that just don't.
No, that
don't.
Poor woman.
Oh, but she loves me. Who wouldn't? Anyways, at EPS has a lot of things going on, but my exposure, my experience there has been predominantly from the engineering perspective, of course. And if you're listening to this podcast and you're learning more about our company, you're just getting familiar with us. I can truly say that the engineering department has a noble objective to pay homage and respect to good engineering practice, to doing the job right, to being a data-driven company. And it is a phenomenal composition of ingredients when you have that kind of attitude and culture combined with the opportunity of innovation in a space that needs innovation. Mm. It is the perfect storm, or the perfect recipe, however you want to take a look at it. Personally, recipe. But it is it's just a phenomenal place to be.
Well, I appreciate it, Joe. Thank you for being on this week. This is actually our 20th episode we have done with the Aviation Renaissance.
Nice.
Yeah, so thank you to all our listeners. Shout out again to JetBlue, just a great company that invested in EPS, hopefully showcasing the reality of what EPS is and will become. And also, please, everyone, leave a 5-star review or some likes and follows as well, and tune in next week at the Aviation Renaissance.
This podcast was brought to you by Electric Power Systems. EPS is a leading provider of high voltage, high power, certifiable electric power systems for high reliability applications. Its mission is to power transportation's electric renaissance by providing smarter, safer, more reliable, lighter, and certifiable batteries.